the JTS website.
All right, because I don't know
okay.
what kind of recording.
Let me see if this is working. I think it is. It says record, and it's like moving, so that means it should be working, right? Okay, so I don't know how formal or informal I should be, but when I teach classes here, I prefer to sit as I am right now on the table. You know, it makes, I mean, on the one hand, you can see me better. On the other hand, I don't have the formality of standing. So I hope this meets with everybody's approval. I'm going to begin, as I always do these events, since the library, as many of you know, runs a series of book talks. And under ordinary circumstances, I am, you know, kind of the moderator. I welcome you all, so welcome everybody, on behalf of the Library of the Jewish Theological Seminary. And I say something like, it is our pleasure to welcome so-and-so, the author of, you know, this very, very important book. You know, I mean, those are the normal kinds of things that I say. So, you know, I'll do the same thing now. I'm David Kramer. I'm director of the Library of the Jewish Theological Seminary. Welcome to all of you to one of our series of book events. And, you know, then I always, as I say something about the importance of the book, right? So here all I'll say is that this is the most important book to be published on the subject of space and place in Rabbinic Judaism in the last 6 months. So, you know, more than that I can't say. I will allow you to judge. Some of you have already approached me about the question of why I'm not selling the book. If you went online to look for its price, you already know the answer to that. I didn't want anybody to feel any obligations. But I will at the end speak not as author, but as librarian, about the question of the cost of academic books, because I think it's actually worth a word or two. But that'll come at the very end and won't be part of my formal presentation. Okay, so the way these things work is that the author, in this case me, or I should say I, will, you know, say something about the book for about 40, 45 minutes, then open up for discussion. There won't be any sales or signing, so you'll be able to get home earlier than you would have been able under other circumstances. Let me say a word about where this began, and then I'm going to do something that I don't ordinarily do. Those of you who have heard me speak before or have been in my classes know that as a teacher or as a speaker, I'm someone who operates without notes. I don't read notes. I don't read text, you know, in that kind of formal way. It's not an approach that I enjoy as a listener all that much, and it's not an approach that has drawn me as a teacher. But in this case, I've actually worked very hard at the formulation of certain things in the books. And so I've decided, quite uncharacteristically, to read some sections of the book for you and then to elaborate them somewhat and then open up for discussion. The subject began for me actually at almost exactly the same time as I was beginning to consider what also became a book. It's the book that I published before this one, Jewish Eating and Identity, which, you know, it was a fulfillment of my kind of love, an expression of my love, both for Judaism and its history, and particular Rabbinic Judaism, though in that case, I went looking for a history of what we might call kashrut, and since I didn't find one, I had to write it. But, you know, I started examining that, and it began to interest me at precisely the same time as I became interested in questions of space and place, which were emerging as a field of study at universities, and there was a new literature developing, and it spoke to, you know, kind of the unknown parts of my mind and my heart, because you know, just very in a very personal way, I'm someone who has always been attracted to questions of the construction of space and the importance of place. I have, for example, though it has nothing to do with my academic interests, or at least didn't begin that way, I've always been interested in cities and read a great deal about urban history and urban planning and so forth. And so when this was developing as an academic field, I simply did, you know, what I think a scholar ought to do, take something or some things that he or she loves, in this case, considerations of place and rabbinics, and put them together and write a book about it. So in one academic year, actually, in two successive semesters, I in one semester taught a course on Jewish eating, which was the beginning of my research for that book, and the very next semester I taught a course on Jewish and most particularly rabbinic relation to space and place, which was the beginning of my thinking for this book. It's what that means, of course, since they began at the same time and I wrote the other book first, is that this has been something that gestated for a very, very long time. But I'm pleased with the outcome, and that's why I share it with you. I've had the experience that when I begin to speak about this, when I try to teach about it, people are often a little bit puzzled at why space and place are of interest beyond some kind of academic theorizing. And so what I'd like to begin with, actually, it involves some academic theorizing, and I'm going to refer to people, in the academy who have written about space and place, who are very, very important to the field. But what I wanted to do was to lay the groundwork for the reader's appreciation of why these categories, or this category, space and place in their way, are different ways of saying the same thing, certainly related things, why it's so important and why it's so central to human experience. I think it's fair to say that important scholarship it relates to not just the particular experience of a group, in this case the group being Jews and more particularly rabbinic Jews, but tries to understand the specific phenomenon in the context of the general. That is to say that Jews or rabbinic Jews will do something in their own way, but what they're responding to is part of a far more general human phenomenon. So where I began the book was by trying to lay out my understanding of the human experience of space. Okay, so I'll read this, I'll try to get it right, just bear it in mind as we go forward. We experience the world through our bodies. Bodies that have height and width and depth and weight. These bodies occupy or take up space, making our first experience of the world spatial. Our bodies orient us in space. We see from here to there. Here is always where we are, and there is always somewhere else. We also hear what is there when we are here. As we move from here to there, and what was formerly there becomes here, because where you are is always here, right? We experience the extension of our bodies moving through another extension, that is, through space. Even if we are bound to a here, we nevertheless feel our bodies move, whether our arms or fingers, or even only our eyelids. But if they move, they always move through space. And even if we don't move at all, a theoretical notion impossible in the absolute unless we're dead, we experience the volume of our bodies as our bottom, that is to say, the soles of our feet or our bottoms or backs, contact the volume below it, which supports it, by virtue of which we are not in free fall. Because we experience space through our bodies and their parts are frequently the measure of our space. Through history, measures of extension have often been given in digits, that is to say fingers, right, or their equivalent, hand breadths, cubits, that is the length between your, elbow, right, and the tip of your middle finger, and the like. Longer distances are measured in units that estimate how far a person can walk in a given period of time. Of course, that means that our experience of time, like all experience also embodied, is tied to space. A product of the calculation, how long does it take us to traverse this distance? Truly, the time-space continuum is implicit in who we are and how we experience the world. Space is essential to our consciousness, inerasable and undeniable. But we cannot speak of space as a neutral entity. We do not approach or experience space unformed, not even the very first time. Our spaces are formed, shaped, constructed. This means that as much as we shape our spaces as we literally construct them and quote unquote shape our spaces as we construct them through our experience, our spaces also shape us. Where we can go and move and sit is limited or controlled by the construction of our spaces. And our relationship to our space is always, therefore, a kind of dialogue. We shape the space, which in turn shapes us in an unending relationship of give and take. This is a good moment to note that we are currently in the process of designing the new space that will be the new library of the Jewish Theological Seminary. So, you know, I feel particularly connected to these ideas as we're going through that. I have a little bit more of this, the introduction, to read. Our bodies live in space. We always need a space or place to be, to live, to dwell. The centrality of space in general to our experience leads to the centrality of places in their specificity to our experiences. This is our city or village. This is our home. This is our place of worship. Our activities happen in places with which we become intimate, places that become ours. Here I eat, warm myself, share stories with my loved ones. This is my home and hearth. Places are consequently central to our memories. Indeed, virtually all of our memories are emplaced. If memory and place are deeply entwined, then place will be thick with meaning, because memory and association is what creates the thickness of meaning. This is true not only for each of us as individuals, but for all of us in combination, as collectives. Communal places, and particularly cities, will therefore often be our most meaningful places, places that preserve and convey our memories, embody and communicate our collective values. As central constructed communal places, cities are the embodiments of who we are. Cities are homes to many of us, from the beginnings of civilization to the present day. They are capitals, cult centers, market and trade centers, and cultural centers. They are centers of production and centers of consumption. As all of these things, they are also powerful symbols. Just think of the meaning of Paris to the French, London to the British, Rome to the Romans, and Jerusalem to Jews, Christians, and to a somewhat lesser degree, Muslims. By virtue of the powerful symbolism of cities, they are often the prime and in some sense final target of conquerors, the most important and often last-ditch foci of homeland defense. Because they are manifestations of national autonomy and power and the centers of national religions, conquest of capital cities is and always was more than a secular act. As Twan, this is, I'm going to reference several scholars, just ignore the names, you know, just put it in the, you know, in the category of scholar of space. As Twan comments, conquerors did not raze a city to the ground simply out of wanton fury. In such destruction, they appropriated a people's gods by rendering them homeless. If the temple and the city were in some sense the home of the god or gods, then conquest of a city was tantamount to conquest of a people's gods. Okay, so these are the very general observations on the level of both personal experience and society. I want to go just a little bit further. One more paragraph comes a little bit later in the introduction before focusing on the experience of Jews in the ancient world. What does it mean for a person to be displaced, deprived of a home? If place is so important, then the elimination of one's home, one's place, has got to be in some manner catastrophic. And so the question is, how do we understand that? Robert David Sack opines that such displacement affects a person to his or her very core. In his words, a person who is homeless or stateless is close to being a non-person, a non-entity. A person is so emplaced, so much of his or her place, that a person displaced is no longer the same person. Allowing for rhetorical exaggeration, not even a person at all. Poulet goes still further, writing that, quote, the being bereft of place is deprived of a universe. He is, so to speak, nowhere. If one is without a home, his universe collapses, leaving him a nowhere man. Needless to say, such a condition is intolerable. Isolated, off balance, without orientation, notice the word orientation, right, means to locate oneself in space by identifying the orient, the east, right, and then relative to other directions, without orientation, and nowhere, the nowhere man, excuse me, can only struggle to recover place and home. Only this will save her or him from experiential and existential annihilation. Okay, so that's the theoretical foundation, theoretical background. And the argument of the book, therefore, or the exploration of the book is, if these things are true, then what was the meaning of the fact to Jews living in the first and into the second century of the Common Era, the fact that their territory was thoroughly conquered, though it had been controlled by the Romans, of course, before. It's not as though, you know, Jews controlled this space or place and all of a sudden their control was eliminated. The Romans and before them, well, we had the Maccabees in between, but before the Maccabees, we had the Greeks. But, you know, all of that being said, the conquest and destruction of the temple in 70, the conquest of Judea, and then the further and irremediable conquest, that is to say the recognition that this was in some way irreversible in the second century at the time of Bar Kokhba, if all of these things are correct, then there's no way to read that situation as other than radically problematic, catastrophic. I mean, you can add whatever word you want to this, and it would become, and here it's important for us to remember, if we go back in Jewish tradition, think about the biblical tradition, right? The biblical tradition, what is its place for place or space? I mean, we all know that. I mean, it's obviously absolutely central, right? Because the covenant itself is tied to the question of place, right, called the land of Israel. Fulfillment of the covenant in, according to the commands of God, of course, leads to peaceful dwelling on the land. The failure to uphold God's commands leads to rejection and displacement from the land. So the centrality of place in biblical religion is unmistakable. Obviously, the rabbis, all Jews, in fact, in the first century and beyond, are the inheritors of this tradition. And so if the temple is destroyed, if people are displaced, then what happens is that on some existential level, if not literal, and it was often both literal and existential, both the people of Israel and Israel's God became homeless. Right? And if homelessness means the kind of ennui that was mentioned, you know, they read the theoreticians a moment ago, then this is an intolerable circumstance. It's an intolerable situation. And one of the central problems, therefore, that the rabbis, as emerging, as aspiring leaders of the Jewish community in the first and second century, that they had to address was, what do we do about this problem of space? And I'll say this and come back to it later. It was not an option to say that space doesn't matter. Right? That was not an option. It wasn't an option, as many of you have heard in the past, because teachers like me have shared such ideas with you. Oh, we became purely portable. You know, space, emplacement no longer mattered. You know, we developed a religion of Torah that could go from here to there, no problem. Even if we did develop a religion of Torah that went from here to there, it's a problem, right? Because there is no community, no collection of individuals to which place doesn't matter, particularly when there's a tradition which focuses on place and emphasizes its importance to the degree that inherited Jewish tradition did at the time of the rabbis. Okay? So is the challenge clear? Is the problem clear? That is the question. That's the challenge that the book seeks to understand. And I think it's unavoidable in trying to make sense of rabbinic religion and therefore of all of Judaism to follow, since, of course, rabbinic religion is the foundation of Judaism as we know it. Okay? Clear enough? Okay. So, what I did in the book was based upon this foundation to try to understand, well, first of all, to try to identify the categories that, you know, anyone looking at them would agree were spatial or placial. I know placial isn't a word, but it is a neologism that I use in the book because we have no other good word for it. So if there's spatial, why shouldn't there be placial, right? So, I mean, those categories that people would identify as spatial or placial, and to examine them carefully in order to try and understand what were the strategies that the rabbis developed or employed in order to deal with the problem of space. I looked at the spatial categories to understand how the rabbis dealt with the problem of displacement or homelessness or whatever word you would like to use. So the chapters of the book reflect that. Let me just read them out to you with slight translations. And then I'd like to illustrate some of the examples and what I found as I was exploring these. And I do have to say that, like any work of scholarship, like any work of reading at all, there's a lot of interpretation of this. One of the things I discuss is what makes an interpretation plausible, what makes an interpretation better or not so good. All of what I'm going to offer is interpretation, which I am willing to defend based upon a very careful reading of the sources. But I can't prove with anything approaching scientific certainty that these interpretations are in fact the explanation of the phenomena I notice. So there are two things here: noticing the phenomena in the rabbinic formulations and then trying to make sense of them. So the categories, first of all, I do have a chapter on what early Christians did with space and place, because it is, at least after its very beginnings, a distinctly different religious configuration, closely related to but different from rabbinic Judaism, certainly. And one of the most important differences is the place of body in the rabbinic religious configuration and in the early Christian and subsequent Christian religious configurations. And if there are different attitudes toward the body, there are going to be different attitudes towards space as well, given what I said in the introduction. Then there's a chapter on, I mean, the obvious one, but it's only where I begin, I leave it behind very quickly, is on what we would identify as sacred place or sacred space, that is to say the temple, and tractate Midot, primarily, though there's some ready. So for those of you who know the tractates, I'll give you the names, but it's about the temple and the rabbinic construction of the temple in the Mishnaic tractate that builds the temple in its imagination. And I do think that it's almost pure imagination. That's all I'm going to say about temple, because almost everybody who speaks about, you know, Jewish space speaks about that. I'd like to address the less expected things. The next is mapping the Holy Land. There I deal with the tractates dealing with fields and those seeds that we are forbidden to mix when we plant them in the fields, how you maintain separation. And as it turns out, this is a place where the rabbis spend a lot of time addressing matters of the relationship of spaces, and particularly question of boundaries, of fences, and so forth. Obviously, the edges of space are always very important. I'll come back to this in a moment. The Sabbath. And here I'll say a word about Heschel going on, because Heschel would ask us not to predict the Sabbath as an important spatial construction, but it is. The Sukkah, which is, you know, obviously a spatial construction, the booth for the for the festival that goes by that name. Then I wanted to make sure, you know, to be as comprehensive as I could, one of the unambiguously spatial tractates, though very different in kind from the others, is the tractate that defines spaces that do or don't contain death impurity. It's called either Ohalot or Ahilot, depending upon the version of this you look at. But you know, the meaning is tents, and what the Bible says, what the Torah says, is that if a deceased person is within a tent, the tent contains the death impurity and renders impure anybody in that space, but also protects anyone who's outside the tent from that same impurity. So the question is, when does something count as a tent? You know, in quotes, when doesn't it count as a tent? And so forth. So ohalot, death tents, is the way I would translate it here. And then two chapters, one of which we would all guess at being spatial, profoundly spatial, but as it turns out, isn't. And that is the rabbinic treatment of synagogues, right? Synagogues for the rabbis are not profoundly spatial. They are obviously places or spaces. I'm using my language carefully, but they are not profoundly spatial. And one that we wouldn't expect to be spatial at all, but in fact is, and that is to say, the rabbinic system of blessings. And so we've got a very diverse range of topics here. And what I'd like to do is to say something about the way certain tractates or certain topics generate rabbinic creativity, and the way other topics or tractates do not generate rabbinic creativity. That's what's most interesting here, is some do and some don't, and the question is going to be why. Right? Why, for example, since everyone teaches the synagogue as the replacement of the temple, why isn't the synagogue an important rabbinic place? And I'll say some words about that as we go forward. So here I'm just going to read to you in several of these topical areas, some representative rabbinic texts and say a word about them. Before I read them, I just want to say the following. If I read them and you find yourself saying, I don't understand a word that he's reading, or I don't understand what the hell is going on here, that's the point. Okay? Right? That will be the point. So if you find yourself in that position, right, you're actually right on target. Okay? So here the topic separating produce in the field. One of the texts in this area reads as follows. A partition of reeds. If there are not between one reed and the next 3 hand breadths, a space wide enough so that a kid may enter, this is considered a partition, right? So if it's more than 3 hand breadths, it's not a proper partition. If there's a space that's less than 3 hand breadths, it still counts as a partition. You don't have to worry about the gap, in other words. And a fence that was breached up to 10 cubits wide, so 10 of these, right? That's a considerable distance. A fence that was breached up to 10 cubits wide, this breach is considered as an opening, meaning an entranceway or a doorway, and all fences have entranceways or doorways, and so they're not considered to be breaches in the fence. They're considered to be natural parts of the fence. You imaginatively fill them in other words, and therefore the fence is deemed as a valid divider. If the breach measures more than this, then opposite the breach it is prohibited to sow different kinds of seeds. If many breaches were breached in the fence, if the combined measure of the parts that remain standing exceeds the combined measure of that which is breached, it is permitted to sow different kinds of seeds on both sides of the fence. So just as long as the standing is more than the open, it counts as a fence, and you can absolutely ignore the gaps. It is permitted to sow different... And if the breach exceeds the standing, then opposite the breach is forbidden, but next to actual fence is permitted. Right? So what you've got here... I thought about doing a PowerPoint presentation, but, you know, I figured it would take too much time. You know, but basically, it works like this. Let's say you've got a fence with space in between, right? This is the way the fence looks, right? You do a measurement. As long as this is more than that, it counts as a fence. You fill in everything in between in your imagination. You don't have to worry about the gaps, right? If this is more than that, then you do have to worry about the gaps, meaning you can't sow different kinds of seeds on either side of the gap, but you can sow on either side here, right? So what we notice here is that the rabbis constructed and manipulated these spaces in the imagination in such a way to make space into fence, to make gap into sealed, and to enable them to control the fields and what could be planted in them in a way that without imagination is literally unimaginable. I know I'm redundant in that, but you get the point that I'm making. So that's one teaching, and that connects to planting the seed. Let me go now to another one that in this case, I'm going to do Sabbath after this, but just to give you, this one is Sukkah. Okay? So Sukkah, you need a proper roof and you need proper walls. But it turns out you only need three walls, and three walls actually means two walls and a little bit. Right? Okay? Again, right? It's the manipulation and power of the imagination. Then you've got to ask what's up above. And one thing I can say here, any of you who have tried to figure out whether a sukkah is kosher or not, you have experienced an anxiety that the rabbis did not want you to have. They were far more lenient in their analysis of roof in definition of space than we latter-day Jews are. I think they just had lower anxiety levels or took better, you know, anxiety-relieving drugs than we do. But, you know, whichever of those is true, it teaches in the Mishnah, if someone covers his sukkah with spits or with bedposts. Now, these are unkosher material for the roof of a sukkah. Nevertheless, if there is a space between them as wide as them, covered with acceptable material, it is kosher, right? And so this is very, very simple. If you've got more kosher than you've got unkosher, the kosher gets rid of the unkosher and you don't have to worry about it. Moreover, if one distanced roof covering from the walls of the sukkah by three hand breadths, leaving space in between, so you've got the wall, you've got space, and then you've got what we call the schach, right, the covering, it is disqualified, right? If it's more than three, but less than three is fine. A house, the roof of which is partially collapsed, and one covered over it for the service to serve as a sukkah, if there is from the wall to the covering a distance of 4 cubits, right? So partially collapsed, 4 cubits, and that's still covered by the roof of the house, it is disqualified, but less than 4 cubits, and again, 4 cubits is a considerable distance, then it's fine. Why? Because in the opinion of the rabbis, a wall that goes like this and has a roof like that, and then in the middle of the roof, there's a hole, and you put the proper covering on top of it, that part of the roof that remains is considered to be bent wall. Right? Right. That part of it up here doesn't count as roof. It counts as bent wall. Now, how many of us would admit that it's actual wall, let alone bent wall? The answer is zero. But what are the rabbis doing once again? They're filling in gaps. They're eliminating the unwanted. They're controlling and manipulating space in order to control and define what will ultimately be what, according to their law only, right? But in a powerfully expressed law, is a space properly defined and controlled by the rabbis for the community of Israel. Okay? Now, I could go on to other areas. I want to focus for a moment on Shabbat, though, and give it a little bit of extra time and then say a word about the non-spatial space areas, which are interesting. Shabbat... famously was described as a sanctuary in space by Abraham Joshua Heschel Jr., right? Was he a junior? No, I'm thinking Martin Luther King, but you understand the confusion since they were the same person, right? Yeah, right, right. In any case, yeah, I mean, that's a beautiful book, a very persuasive book. Unfortunately, I would say it's also a very wrong-headed book, the conclusions of which with respect to Sabbath as a spatial construction or lack thereof are actually highly misguided. To defend Heschel, he was writing an anti-technology polemic in the aftermath of the Holocaust. If you read the book carefully, it will be clear to you that that's what the book is. He recognized the grave damage that modern technologies could do, and so wrote a polemic against those technologies. At the same time, this was the late 40s, the early 50s, the Jewish community that he saw before his eyes, that is to say the Jewish community here in the US of A, was moving to the suburbs and building these immense sanctuaries. and he wanted to argue against that as well. So the book is a twofold polemic. Unfortunately, in the polemic, he says a lot of very proper and right things, but he gets the Sabbath seriously wrong. The Sabbath, first of all, put the first point on the table, the word Sabbath is both a noun and a verb. Right, the verb is lishpot, and it's used biblically that way. It's used rabbinically that way. We often translate it as to rest, although to cease would also be a perfectly good translation. And what's crucial, whether it's rest or cease, is the recognition that it means to rest or cease in space. In other words, very clearly in the rabbinic vocabulary, lishpot means more than anything else to find the place where your Sabbath begins and recognize that that is your home for the Sabbath. And unless certain other things are true, you're not permitted to leave that place. Right? So more than anything else, the Sabbath defines a place where you are bound for the entirety of that occasion. Okay? Now, the best known part of the Sabbath map is the Eruv. Right? Now, the Eruv, I mean, all of you think, what kind of divider is this? A little wire right on top of God knows what. Any of you who have not seen from the olden days the Daily Show's report on the proposed Eruv in the Hamptons, you can Google this. We immediately appreciate why else would it be on the Daily Show other than that it's silly on some level. But the rabbis recognized that it was silly because the very same things that they said with respect to keeping, to fences that kept seeds separate, they applied to the fences of the Sabbath, going still further, talking about strings and the distance of strings, and even a tiny string, so long as it doesn't have three hand breadths between it, still counts as a fence and so forth. In other words, there's no divider, but in the imagination, the rabbis create a divider, because what matters is the definition of the space where you find yourself on the Sabbath. That's map number one. Map number two, which is less well known, but certainly no less important, is what is more properly actually called the Sabbath boundary map. This has nothing to do with carrying an Eruv, but it is equally as central to the conception of the Sabbath. Jews are restricted to walking 2,000 cubits. This is according to rabbinic understanding. 2,000 cubits, so whatever that times 2,000 is, beyond their Sabbath dwelling place on the Sabbath. So if you are out in a desert and the Sabbath begins, you've got only 4 cubits in any direction. That's your Sabbath home, right? And you may or may not be able to go 2,000 cubits beyond that, depending upon certain conditions. If you live in a city or in a village, then your Sabbath space combines with the Sabbath space of the other people with whom you live. And then your question is the boundary of the... the boundary of the city. But the way this works, which is actually quite extraordinary, let's say you've got, right, the only city that you would have no problem with is a city that looked like that. If you live in a city that's that shape, it's very easy to apply Sabbath law. How many of you live in a city that's shaped like that? Not so many, right? Let's say you live in a city that's shaped like that. I don't know, there's a river on one side, there are mountains on the other hand, you get the basic points. Then, in order to define the map of the Sabbath city, you go like this. Okay? And then, from there, you go 2,000 cubits in any direction. In other words, the actual city is almost never the Sabbath city. The rabbis, by definition, defined the city as looking like this, whatever the real shape. It's always oriented north-south, right? Or north-south, east-west. It's always squared like this, and you always fill in gaps in the city. And so you'll be able to find Mishnah texts, for example, which talk about a city shaped like a bow. And you'll find, city shaped like that. So if you've got a city shaped like that, you fill in the space. This is considered to be all filled in. You then go like that. This is also considered to be filled in. You go like that, and you can go 2,000 cubits from the edges. Again, what we see here is this extraordinary, and I would even say aggressive, act of imagination. I mean, it's really amazing. So this is Sabbath map number two, but that's not all we have. So we've got the Eruv, the carrying map. We've got the Sabbath map that looks like that with, you know, this kind of filling in. And then there's a third map, which we're less sensitive to, but it's no less important. There's the domestic Sabbath map, which is defined, I would call it the Muktzah map. And some of you know the word muktzah, others don't. Muktzah defines those objects that you're not permitted to handle on the Sabbath. Now, when you're not permitted to handle an object on the Sabbath, what that does, okay, so, you know, let's say I've got, you know, something, you can, a gun, let's say, right? No handling guns on the Sabbath. I don't know if that's true, but I'm going to make it true. You know, you put a gun down on a table. What that means is that not only the gun you're not permitted to handle, but the table under it. You're not permitted to handle. And so, when you walk into a space, if you are a Sabbath-observing person, what you've got to do is you've got to look at the domestic space and literally map it. That I can use, that I can use, that I can touch, that I can't touch. Every space will have that kind of map. So not only is the Sabbath centrally spatial, contra Heschel, but it is more spatial than any other construction in its theorizing because it's got not one map, but three maps. Okay, so putting the temple aside, temple's a unique construction. You've got fields in the land of Israel, you've got Sukkot, and you've got the Sabbath. Quite different is the tents, the death tents, because if you read through, and I'm not going to encourage you to do this, but if you do learn the tractate on death tents, what you will discover is that the rabbis approach it as the Bible does, as a kind of physics. In other words, they actually believe that death impurity has got a physical reality. It's a kind of viscous semi-gas. And if you understand the properties of that viscous semi-gas, you will know where it spreads to and where it doesn't. In other words, there's no imagination involved at all. Unlike what we saw in these cases, where there's an aggressive manipulation of imagination, in death tents there isn't. Okay, so that is in one category. I have to point out that a category that might seem very spatial, you know, you're required to leave the corners of your field for the poor. I also deal with that in the discussion of the prohibition of mixing the seeds. Interestingly, there's a lot of this spatial manipulation, again, aggressive with the with the seeds and their prohibition of mixing, but not when they define fields for purposes of the corners that have to be left for the poor. Also very interesting. Then we've got two other categories. Synagogue is not, as I said before, is not spatial. Why is that the case? This is actually a shocking recognition. First of all, if you go looking for laws regulating the construction of a sukkah, you will have no problem finding them, and they're abundant. If you go for laws for the construction of the temple, laws for the construction of your field, laws for construction of the Sabbath, all of those abundant. Laws for the construction of a synagogue regulating, there are almost none. Literally none in the Mishnah, and almost none in the Gemara. And the question becomes why? The answer, I think, I'll come to answers in a moment. So that's synagogue. Blessings, which I mentioned, is very interesting. One of the chapters of the Tractate on Blessings begins with the words, Haro'eh makom shana'asu bo nisim liYisrael. Right? If someone sees a place in which miracles were done for Israel, one recites the following blessing. And then that chapter goes on to define a variety of phenomena and places. Right, and the phenomena are always in place as well, where you recite a blessing. So blessings relate to spaces. The Gemara, the Talmud, expands upon that and says, not only where Israel experienced miracles, but where you yourself experienced miracles. Right? And so if you were walking along and, oh my God, a car, jumped the curb and it hit a wall in front of you, but you were not harmed, you experienced a miracle in that place, and you would therefore, every time you see that place, you would recite a blessing. Right? And so very, very different, but no less in place than the other things that we saw before. The question then becomes, what distinguishes these different categories? And the thesis that I develop, and I'm aware of the time, so I want to leave time for some, a few questions or comments, is that the places where the rabbis most aggressively exercise the spatial imagination is in those matters that most capture the covenantal relationship between God and Israel. Okay? Fields in the land of Israel, Right? The land of Israel is an expression and realization of the fulfillment of the covenant between Israel and God. Right? So that's land as an expression of covenant. Sabbath is explicitly defined in the Torah as a sign, oti, beini uveimene Israel, a sign of the covenant between Israel and God. And sukkah is a sign, not only, I mean, we all know the historical explanation of sukkah. What's most interesting is that the rabbis reject the historical explanation of sukkah. They don't think that Sukkot are meant to symbolize Sukkot in the desert. What they think is that the schach, the covering, is meant to represent the protective presence of God. And therefore, the sukkah represents the most intimate connection between God and Israel. And so what we see is that the temple is obviously where Israel meets God. But what we see is those places that most powerfully represent the relationship between God and Israel in covenant are the places where this imagination, this spatial imagination, is exercised. Even in the Sabbath, which, here I'll give Heschel credit, need not be as spatial as it is. And yet it is profoundly spatial by virtue of this quality. The reason death tents don't have any imagination at all is because they actually represent the opposite of a close covenantal relationship between God and Israel. Death and death and purity are about the estrangement between God and Israel, or God and the human who experiences death or experiences the presence of death. And I would submit synagogue and blessings represent what might appear to be a very different strategy. Right? One strategy rebuilds places. That's what the fields do, that's what the Sabbath does, that's what the temple does, that's what Sukkah does. It rebuilds space, some of which are literal and some of which are hoped for, but literally or, you know, in study, rebuilt spaces. The synagogue, though, is very interesting. So in the Gemara, there's the following discussion. Where in Babylonia is the divine presence? Abaye said, in the synagogue of Hotzal and in the synagogue of Shaf V'Yativ in Nahardea. Right? And then there's a discussion, and, you know, a certain rabbi meets the divine presence in that particular synagogue that was just mentioned. But the question, and I intentionally don't translate this here, question is, what is the synagogue of Shaf V'Yativ? Shaf V'Yativ means something like flew and settled. And the way Rashi and others explain it, and it seems to me inevitably correct, is that the synagogue which flew and settled is built on the foundation of stones from the Temple of Jerusalem. That is the tradition that attaches to this. And so the claim is that the synagogue as a replacement of the temple is an expression of the fact that even the temple in Jerusalem is not in one place, but can be realized in any place. The reason, therefore, the rabbis do not legally construct the synagogue is because they don't want to fix it. They don't want to pin it down. They want it, like blessings, to be anywhere. But then comes the irony, and that irony is that, of course, even the places they construct with this aggressive imagination, the Sabbath, the sukkah, and so forth, they too are portable, because while they may be buildable once a week or once a year, nevertheless, for the rabbis, it's the study of these laws as much as the fulfillment of the laws themselves, which is central to constructing the space, right? And if you can construct the space by studying the space, then of course you can do that anywhere. That's the observation often made about the Torah, right, which is also portable. So ironically, the rabbis reconstruct, claim control of space. And that's what their law does. They claim control of space, but they control it from anywhere they might study it. So the apparently different strategies for space that the rabbis develop are actually far closer than they might first appear. I want to say one final thing. In the end of this, I get into what all of this means about Judaism subsequently. Just one very, very simple thing. This is about our own age, right? I don't want to leave this in the past. So I'm talking here about medieval Judaism first and the way it incorporated these considerations, and then into modern Judaism. And I see modern Judaism as a real break because of a variety of historical factors. But the other reaction to modern developments to stubbornly persistent anti-Semitism, a new secular ideology of Zion also hoped for a new Jewish place, this time in an old Jewish place. Return to the land, plant the soil, rebuild the home. This, many came to believe, was the solution to the Jewish future. As this hope grew to reality, as the land was settled and planted, territory conquered and controlled, a nation state founded, attachment to the land grew more and more powerful. Every stone, every plot of this particular earth came to be indispensable. Further, when in 1967 all of the land from the sea to the Jordan came under Israeli control, an ideology of restoring biblical Israel, now viewed by many as a religious obligation, asserted itself. Judea and Samaria must be settled. One who discusses trading pieces of land away is a traitor. The influence of this ideology and the political power of those who hold it have only become more powerful and influential in the decades following. This extreme modern Jewish ideology of place. Okay, I know what I'm saying here, right? Meaning I'm saying it with great intent. Extreme modern Jewish ideology of place is the polar opposite of the assimilated European Jewish alternative described above. In other words, Zionism was one response. One response was to give up on any kind of hope of return at all, right? To say we are part of this, you know, and so forth. The point is that with regard to both of them, that both of them, meaning both the extreme Zionist and the assimilationist modern, both of them are every bit as much a denial of the rabbinic compromise, right? The rabbi sought to find a line between them. The earlier one, that is to say the assimilated one, abandoned the rabbinic retention of the land as a powerful symbol and object of hope. This one, the extreme Zionist one, rejects the rabbinic recognition that the home of Jews and their God must be mobile and flexible. But occasional extremes are unavoidable. The pressures of certain ages and conditions lead people where they might not otherwise go. Unavoidably, the rabbinic balance has sometimes given way to imbalanced choices. That's not the end, but it at least captures an important point that I make at the end. So we've got at least 6 or 7 minutes, and if you have a little bit of patience, we can go beyond that. So I welcome any kinds of questions or comments, and then I'll say a word about the price of the book. Anybody? Yes?
Okay. Little bit off topic, that's why I didn't shoot my hand up immediately. But you raise a question when you're talking about the death tense.
Yes.
That I've never quite understood. And maybe in this context you can explain to me. I was brought up to believe that you actually shouldn't even cry at funerals because the dead person has been brought into the presence of God. And yet, mm-hmm. I've also been told that a Kohen cannot go into a house of death.
Uh-huh.
So on the one hand, death is the highest thing we should all want, being in the presence of God and His holy.
Uh-huh.
On the other hand, it is spatially unholy. It's tight.
Okay, so very good question. It also so happens the book before the one on food was on death practices. So I also studied this. You know, death, food, and I don't know, but this one is less. People said you're going to do death, food, is money or sex next. But, you know, the answer is neither. First of all, I'll just refer to rabbinic and therefore to subsequent traditional Jewish practices. There is no doubt that crying is essential to Jewish funerals. So much so that it was part of the Roman world that there were professional wailers, women who served as professional wailers. These were part of Jewish practice as much as they were part of Roman practice. And one of the assumed conditions of a ketubah, a Jewish marriage document, that a husband undertakes an obligation to his wife, is that if she predeceases him, he is obligated to hire wailers in order to assure that there are people crying at her funeral. Whatever he thought about her, in other words, you know, there will be some who will be crying. I think the question of death and purity is complicated. It means simultaneously estrangement from and proximity to God, and it's far too complicated to comment on that, even in an hour, let alone in a minute, so that one I'm just going to leave. Other comments or questions? So in the end, you're not interested in space. Okay, yeah.
Could you just talk for a moment about the separation all kinds of things. Why are we separating one kind of seed from another kind of seed?
You mean what's the reason for the biblical law?
Not just that one. All over everything that you've talked about here seems to involve some kinds of
Separation, right.
And I'm not clear
why that's important at all.
Well, what does it mean? Of course it's important. Mm-hmm. What does it mean to it? What are we talking about?
Because, well, listen, I mean, we would, you know, immediately recognize and certainly agree that there's no space or certainly place without boundaries, right? Spaces are constructed through boundaries. Humans in undefined, meaning without definition, without boundary space, I mean, you're totally lost. You erect walls, put a roof on it, and all of a sudden you've got a cathedral. I mean that quite literally. And so scope, I mean, what's amazing is if you look at a certain space, so, you know, say to yourself, how large is the space between Amsterdam Avenue and Morningside Drive and 112th and 113th Street? You'd say, okay, it's one block north to south, not such a big deal. You know, Amsterdam to Morningside, okay, you know, I mean, a little bit long. But then you step into St. John the Divine and you say, oh my God. I mean, this is not only a soaring, I mean, it's a magnificent space, but it's also huge, right? So the irony is that you cut off the edges of the space, and only then do you detect how grand, what the size might be. All definition obviously requires those boundaries. The fields are an interesting thing. I think the reason the rabbis aggressively imagine and construct the fields and the prohibition of mixing this seed with that. I don't know what the reason of the law is. I mean, that's one of the great mysteries. But the reason they choose that to define the boundaries of and not the fields, the corners of which are left for the poor, is because payah, right, leaving the corner for the poor, is an obligation between a person and his or her neighbor. In other words, the direction of the relationship is on this level. It's my obligation to you, your obligation to me. Nothing could be more purely about the relationship between Israel and God than the arbitrary set of laws that define what you can plant together and not, right? Which have no good practical purpose and are simply, the way the rabbis, I think, correctly understand it, kind of an arbitrary command that God says, do this. Why? Because I said so. And therefore, it's just about that relationship. Yes.
So space has something to do with the management or control of what's inside, what's outside.
Mm-hmm.
What about separation? I'm thinking specifically of separation among Jews and Mithraism.
Yeah, what's interesting about all of the spatial categories is that none of them actually effectuates those separations. I mean, if they had, then I would have had an interesting direction to go. But, you know, none of them says you erect an edge between this group and that group by doing the following. I think the area that comes closest is Eruv, in Sabbath law, where there are Jews who accept Eruv as an institution. Those are rabbinic Jews, right? And there are other Jews, non-rabbinic Jews, who never heard of an Eruv, have no interest in an Eruv, and don't want the rabbis to speak to them about Eruv. And the rabbis speak about this in the Mishnah, and they say that Jews who accept Eruv as a concept may not dwell in the same courtyard as Jews who don't accept Eruv, right? But so that comes closest. But I think, ironically, what that's about is that there are certain Jews, rabbinic Jews, who actually accept the power of the definition of space, and other Jews who disregard it, right? So it doesn't quite fit that as well. It is about the kind of separation you're talking about, though. I can't think of another example. I really can't. I mean, in all of these materials. Anybody else? Yes?
Well, I haven't played this out fully, but I'm thinking about what you're saying is that there's something about the space can define the home.
Mm-hmm, right.
Fill the space. Reflects the character of the person in mm-hmm. space, and separating out a people
mm-hmm.
from others, it reflects relationships. It's like the issue of, if you will, the seeds. On a certain level, it's not merely the physical
mm-hmm.
Object of the seeds,
mm-hmm.
but on another level, it can be kind of a parable.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the wrong word, but to tell how we should have our relationships, who we should mix with or not mix with.
Well, I mean, this comes to the prior point, and I mean, listen, all space, when we find ourselves in space or we define place as important, I mean, for example, the blessing that says when you see a place where Israel experienced the miracle, the implication powerfully is that it's the community that shares the significance of that space. So inevitably, of course, you know, spaces will be significant to shared groups. But again, you know, when we talk about in-group, out-group, the definition between one group and another, that doesn't occur here centrally. There's a lot more to be said. Let me explain. I mean, obviously, you know, I only was able to touch on certain very limited parts of this. Let me explain why I have no copies of the book to sell and sign here. The answer, as some of you know, is because it's an immensely expensive book. That is to say, it's an academic book. And academic books, as those of us who acquire works for libraries know, are very, very expensive. In this case, $145. Right, but I have two things to say about that. First of all, the reason that they're published that way is because this is something I got in the mail not long ago. It's called University Business, and this is about university book publishing. And so the writer, who is arguing actually that so few academic books are sold and they're so expensive that we ought to just offer them for free, because what we actually get, in other words, either charge $2,000 or charge nothing, and doesn't actually make a difference at all. And the reason is because a book printed by a standard university press, I was stunned, I sort of knew this, but I actually thought that the Jewish market was smaller than other markets, so I assumed that this wouldn't be true of the other markets. It turns out that it is. A book printed by a standard university press and read only by people who pay for a copy might have an ultimate audience of about 250.
Wow.
So all of the work that goes not into writing the book, but into, you know, the printing, the publication, the editing, all that, for 250 people. I mean, so part of the reason they price books as they do is because they expect libraries to cover the cost of the publication, meaning the universities that support the libraries, and only after they cover their costs that way will they, you know, reduce the price and sell them more broadly. And of course, that way it's a year or two before they even give a, you know, think about that. The other thing I want to say is, right, so I spent a lot of time in this book. I have no idea whether what it's, you know, written in it is valuable or not, although I'd like to believe that it is, and I hope that you were persuaded that it's important. But, you know, I wonder at our values sometimes. So, for example, I went skiing at Vail a couple of weeks ago, and I went online to buy a lift ticket, and lo and behold, a day lift ticket at Vail was $175, right? Any of you who have been, you know, to an orchestra seat at a Broadway show recently know that it's $165. Forget about the secondary market for Hamilton. Okay? So if you think about it, it's expensive, but it lasts a lot longer than the play, right? It's a heck of a lot safer to read the book than it is to go up on the ski lift, right? And in the end, you might even get as much pleasure. So that's all I have to say about the price. Thank you for coming. And one last thing I want to add, because I sometimes remember to do this and sometimes don't, my colleague and assistant Hector Guzman, who is central to helping us lead these, all of these book talks would be impossible without him, so thank you, Hector, for supporting this. And thank you for coming.
One of us. One of us. Oh, I'm sorry. I think that wasn't...